Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone.
Checking 1, 2.
Here's your host, Paul Mercurio.
Hey, folks, welcome to the podcast. Before we get to my guest this week, I just wanted to say thanks to everybody in Philly who came out to the Punchline, had a great time. And a lot of people there said they wanted to check out the podcast and subscribe. And if you have, please go to iTunes and review the podcast. It's real simple. It takes a second, and it's great to get some nice feedback. If you don't like the podcast, then don't say a damn thing. Hope you're going to enjoy it if you're just new to the podcast. And please tell your friends about the podcast. It's a free download, and have a great guest every week. This weekend, if you want to see me doing stand-up, March 9th to the 11th, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I'm going to be in Nyack, New York, just outside of New York City, at a place called Levity Live. Beautiful big comedy club, Levity Live in Nyack, New York. March 23rd to the 26th, I'm going to be in Edmonton, Canada at the Comic Strip Comedy Club in Giant Mall out there. And March 29th to April 1st, one of my favorite clubs, The Punchline in San Francisco. And also April 13th to the 15th, I'm going to be at the Comedy Castle in Royal Oak, Michigan, just outside of Detroit. All great clubs. Hope you can make it if you're in the area. My guest this week, my old buddy Rob Corddry. We worked together on The Daily Show. Really fun conversation with him. He is just as fun in conversation as he is in movies and TV. We talk about a whole bunch of cool stuff. I think you're really going to enjoy it. And please go review the podcast. Thanks for checking it out this week. Hello, buddy. Thank you for doing this. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you for having me on. We had a great time rolling up to the role. So
we did.
I hope... We should have recorded that and thrown
it actually is all recorded, but I'll only put it in. I'll go back and assess if it should go in. But we were discussing the fact that you have this giant palatial estate with this massive industrial air conditioner that makes so much noise you have to turn it off because you sit naked in a rubber suit. That's kind of what everybody missed right there.
Let's let your listeners hear me shut it off. It's on. Listen to the difference in quality. Listen to the difference that a Honeywell air conditioner can make.
Was that beep the air conditioner or was that your pacemaker?
That was that. No. My pacemakers don't make sounds.
No, they don't.
That'd be awful. I hope they don't. I don't know. I'm not a doctor.
Well, I would think you would want it to alert you that you're about to die. No?
I don't know. I'd want it to be like, I'm a pretty tech savvy guy. I think I'd want it to like send me a tweet or an email, sort of like your Nest thermometer. You know,
and the Twittersphere is such assholes that people would then start shitting on your pacemaker.
Well, I'd think twice about like having it automatically posted on Facebook or Twitter.
Because you know some asshole out there will make some snide remark.
I love the assholes on Twitter. I love it.
Oh my God.
I know a lot of comics have trouble with it, and they engage.
Yeah, no, that's the key. Do you engage? Well, I'm sure.
Sometimes.
Do you get some like nasty shit and then you go back?
Sometimes, yeah. I go back, but I'll go back with like, but look, no matter who we get this from, unless they're another comedian, and that's a whole different thing. That's happened too.
Has it really?
Not to me. No, not to me. To other people.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of feuds that happen, but like, I'm not saying like I'm the best comedian in the world. I'm probably just the second best next to you. But like, this is what we rewrite jokes for a living. So,
right.
If I put 30 seconds of thought into it, I'm gonna be able to write a pretty okay comeback.
Right.
And it's usually just shorter, the better. And I just retweet it, or sometimes I just retweet the insult and let my followers pounce on it. That's usually what happens.
That's like, you know, it's funny. It's the online version of a comedy club heckling experience. And it's exactly this thing. Like, it very rarely happens anymore that somebody will like truly like heckle me on stage, but every once in a while, it's usually a drunk chick who thinks she's going to be like whatever. I actually had one thrown out in Canada. She was such a bitch. She was 21 with a 6-month-old kid, and she was there with her boyfriend. Her boyfriend was a fan and had seen me before. And she was a little snotty and shitty, and she was getting more and more drunk. And then I finally, like 5 minutes left in my set, she started interrupting my setups, and I'm like, you know what? I'm done with you. You're gone. And she flips me the bird like this. Like she flips me the bird. I'm doing like this, like you can see me.
Yeah. But, you know, right, like that kind of bird.
Okay, you don't have to be sarcastic, asshole. And And she goes, yeah, right. And I go, no, you're gone. And the whole place starts applauding, right? It's a sold out show. They're all applauding. And the security guy goes over and he looks and he goes, shrugs his shoulder. He goes, Comet wants you out. You got to go. And, she goes, and then her face was the best face ever, Rob, because it went from like snotty, shitty, whatever, to like this face like, you're throwing me out? And I go, yep. And I go, do you want to know why? She goes, why? I go, because you're 21 with a baby and you're not married, and chances are you haven't figured out yet that there are ramifications to your actions in life. And you have to understand that when you're a bitch and an asshole to somebody, you can't just think you can do it without getting slapped down for it. So hopefully this is going to teach you and everybody in your personal life a lesson and make everybody's life around you better, that you can't just walk around being a bitch.
Yeah.
And the boyfriend stood up and goes, I'm so sorry.
Oh.
He goes, can I come back and see you the next time you're here? I won't bring her. I go, no, you can bring her. I said, just amazing. Teach her some fucking manners. Like, and I gave her a long rope. Like, I'm not one of these guys that snaps. Like, I get it. It's an interactive kind of show, and the nature of stand-up is breaking the fourth wall and all that stuff. So I let it go. I fucked around with her. I gave her a ton of opportunities to calm down. And it's kind of – and then the reason I brought this up is you said, you know, you do this for a living, you're going to have a pretty good comeback. I say that to people. I go, you know, I could do this all day with you. This is what I'm kind of trained to do, is deal with people. Why are you fucking with me like this? But just leave it alone. It's crazy.
I know. It's. I'm glad you did that, because you're talking about accountability, basically.
Yes.
And a 21-year-old doesn't have any, especially nowadays. So that's the thing. Like, I am – people are shocked at this, but I am all for regulating the internet. Like, let there be rules, let there be things you can and can't do. And one of them is anonymous posting.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
it is not that it bothers me so much. I take almost no stock in put any value in what they're saying. You know, and even with people I know, I give insults and compliments the same amount of, I weigh them by their merit. You know,
right, exactly.
You're right. Compliments, you know, very few compliments, I believe. So I think, like, it's changing things that people are, they don't have to be accountable for who they are.
Right. And I think it also, what it does is that I think we live in a culture, I mean, especially with reality TV and everything else, that more and more people in 2013 are seeing, I could be a star, and it's allowing people to essentially have some celebrity, whether even through Twitter. You know, I know that there, because I go on some shows regularly, so these shows have a following. And then there's one show I go on. So what these people do is these fans become crazy fans of the show and then tweet about the show, and then they develop a following being like a super fan. So it's like the old days of the 50s when there was a president of the fan club. Well, the president of the fan club is the psycho bitch that stays home and fucking tweets all night about the show. There's this one woman. She watches every single one of these shows 5 nights a week. She grades the show, overall grade of the show, makes a little I'm not shitting you, and then grades each guest on the show. Okay.
Yeah.
So I go on the show one night, and I got, you know, recently, a few months ago, Paul McCartney to be on my podcast. Now, right. You and I know each other. You know each other. Well, I'm not a braggart, but I was really proud of that. That's not an easy get. And I was proud of the interview that I did with him. And it was crazy. It was insane. It was surreal on a gazillion levels.
Right.
So I went on the show and I said to them, look, I'd really like you to plug this podcast that just came out with Paul McCartney. Now, the guys on the show have the show. They're big. We're friends. They're fans. And so we basically, the whole first act was them busting my balls about the Paul McCartney interview. Like, how did you get it? Did you kidnap him? But it was a perfect PR, right? It was all fun and whatever. So she writes some snide remark in this tweet about why so much time spent on Paul McCartney. And she just like shit on it, shit on me. I got so, and I never respond. My wife's like, don't engage. I'm like, fuck this. And I wrote back something to the effect of, it's a sad commentary on your life that you're every night alone in your home spending time grading a late night TV show. And I just lambasted her, right? And you know what the people came back with? Oh, she didn't really mean it. You went kind of hard on her. And I wrote back, well, now you know how what it feels like. I said in the tweet, and then a series of tweets, I said, you can't put yourself out there halfway. You can't expose yourself to sort of want to ridicule people, but then want to be protected from your ridicule. If they can, you know, and I think it's a big problem. I think you're right. Regulation maybe is the way to go.
I think, I mean, something like that, like, you know, And yeah, like who the hell is she? And I hate the excuse. I hate the excuse. Like, dude, I was only kidding. Like, oh, I'm a comedian, so just insults without a joke in them are funny.
Yeah, exactly. And there was nothing. There was nothing joking about it. It was like complete.
Right.
I would have had more respect for her and for her friends if she just said, "Yeah, I said it, and go fuck yourself," and they told me to just jump off a bridge. You know,
yeah,
what I mean? It's like
exactly.
It's this cowardice nonsense. And so I try not to engage, and then I try not to. You know, it's hard, but it's hard not to look, right? Don't you look after?
Yeah,
you do
I totally
show?
Look. See, I don't mind it though. Like I to try not to engage is good, but. Yeah. You've really got to try to let it not bother you. And that'll change your life.
How do you
you know
do
what
that?
I mean?
Do the reviews? I mean,
exactly.
Usually don't get bad
I do.
Reviews. But
I
but,
read them all. As a matter of fact,
really?
I got one on the AV Club for Children's Hospital that aired last night. I can't wait to read it. I haven't read it yet. I'm like, oh, my gosh. It's almost 2 o'clock. I haven't read it yet. Like, I love it. I love reading it. I don't care. I like to hear how people engaged with the stuff. Mm. For me, I don't have too much ego about it. I'd like to get a good review, sure. But even if I'm not mentioned, it's not too much of a bummer. Like, like I said before, like I value criticism and compliments the same. And if they say something true, it will resonate with me. I'll know it, good or bad. And I'll respond to that. In my own, like I had somebody like an agent type of person be very honest with me, not in a harsh way, but it was in a way that agents usually aren't known to. And
about your acting, because I've always
acting, just about career in general. And if you're in a place where you can take criticism and have managed compliments, then you can actually use that kind of shit. Like if it's you could actually. Really,
yeah.
I can apply that to my life. I'm actively applying a fix to what that person.
How were you always wired that way, starting out, or did you eventually figure that out? How did you fix that?
I don't know.
Seriously, drugs, therapy.
I think it was.
Yeah. Did you get a coffee enema in Mexico? What happened?
That doesn't work. That just makes you feel. It makes your tummy hurt. I think one of the things was that that I never stopped reading all that shit, and I never, you know, and I heard everybody say, "Don't do it," you know, "Don't read it, don't read it, don't read it." And I always thought every time I'd read one, I'd say, "Oh, I shouldn't read this," and then I just gradually—it's a very gradual process. I was like, "This doesn't bother me," and I guess I could trace it to anything in my personality that I'm non-competitive to a fault, meaning like I'm terrible at sports because I have no sense. I have no feeling for competition. I don't enjoy it.
Well, you know, I saw that. I mean, for listeners who don't know, you and I worked together on The Daily Show. You were there for 5 years and you were just always such a great, upbeat, positive guy. You know, you'd shit on people, but you would do it behind their backs, which I thought was really...
exactly.
You know, up in that big conference room, we would hang out in there, and you'd write shit on the bathroom walls about John. But and it's rare that, like, you kind of... And I'm not saying this because you're on the podcast and we're friends or whatever, but, like, you know what I mean. There are just some people that just can't take joy in other people's joy, and they can't, you know...
Also,
and
it's a comedy... thing. It's a
especially
that a lot
comedians.
Of
oh
comedians
my God.
Have, especially stand-ups. I could not thrive in that kind of arena and be happy, I don't think, because a stand-up, I think one of the only, like, forms of comedy or genres, whatever you want to call it, that is truly an art and a craft, and it is something that it is fearless and, you know, I would never do it. Because I'm in a position now where I could probably, like, throw together an act and probably just book gigs, which would be... I think it's kind of lame when people do that, like, just because based on their... that they have an audience already.
Speaking of Twitter, there's fucking guys that have amassed a following, 140 characters at a time, and then go out on tour And they got 20 minutes of an act and they're charging $40 a head and they don't have 45 minutes and people get pissed and say, this is bullshit. They're like, it's insane. But, you know, that's kind of where we are, you know.
Well, there's guys that like, it's also changed performing a little bit in a way for the better too. On the other side of it, like say a guy like Bo Burnham is great and he's just a YouTube sensation.
Yeah.
But he didn't change his thing. He's not getting up there trying to do what you do.
Right.
He's working something like that into what he already did, which is fun.
Yeah, and Bo's not the kind of guy I'm talking about. You know
what, you know,
like,
no, I know exactly.
I don't want to mention names, but you know what I mean. It's like guys, like, okay, well, great. You're funny at 140 characters. And there's no bitterness on my part. It doesn't have any effect on me if someone's doing well or not. But comedians, it's funny because people say to me, and I think it's different in the improv world. Well, you came out of acting, straight acting, and then the improv world. I feel like, because I've done some stuff at UCB, it's just a more supportive atmosphere. Yeah. Did you find that?
Absolutely. And I think it shaped a lot of my business philosophy as well as creative philosophy, which is basically just to surround yourself with cool people and do cool shit and no dicks. So it's like, but also the first thing you learn at the UCB specifically, because improv can be as douchey as anything. The first thing you learn is that if you make your partner work to make your partner in a scene look good, and you'll look good by default. Mm-hmm. And that sort of changed the way I look at life in a way. Like, as long as the thing I'm doing and the people I'm surrounding, like, I always surround myself with people. I always want to do projects with people that are smarter than me.
Right.
Because I don't have an ego about it and I'll get smarter.
Yeah. Well, and that's not hard for you to find. It's not like,
no, it really isn't. As you know,
I think I just insulted you. That's the worst.
You're joking.
I don't think you should do that when you have a guest on your show, but I do it anyway.
You're joking.
Well, you know, Carson had that theory. I'm joking. Totally. I mean, you're a very bright guy in your own, but Carson had that same theory of like, he would say, I don't care who's getting the biggest laugh. It doesn't have to be me. Cause when people go home and they just say, hey, did you see the Carson show? It was a great show. You know what I mean? Like, but not a lot of people, especially stand-ups, have that. They got to win. It's got to be about them.
You don't. It's all you. So I can understand that's a harder thing to be able to, harder mind space. I don't know how you do that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you know, the one thing you did coming into the Daily Show, which always impressed me, and I don't know if I ever told you this personally, and if I didn't, I apologize. And people have to understand, you know, when you come into the Daily Show as a correspondent, as you did. You know, at that point, was it 2002, I think? Do I have that date right? Or
I think so, yeah. Early
2000. Right, yeah. You know, you got some history behind you to live up to, whatever, and you're coming into whatever. It's not easy because you got to find your character and you got to try to have your character be hopefully different than characters that were on the show before you and also different than the existing characters and other correspondents on the show. And you were able to carve out a character for yourself. And I really give you a big compliment for that because it's not easy to do. It's a nuanced thing you got to do there. Even though the character might be big. I mean, Carell kind of had the, you know, super dumb guy that thinks he's got it right. And Colbert was sort of the, you know, the blowhard that thought he knew it all, but didn't like, how did you develop your character for that? I mean,
Two things. First of all, I don't know where I came to this, but at some point I either consciously or unconsciously decided that the smartest thing to do is to just copy Colbert. Because that's the thing that I tell everybody, like when my brother joined the show and Jason Jones and Dan Bacadal, like they were like, how'd you find a character? How do I find a character? Do I have to choose a character? And I'm like, no, copy Colbert for a while. And then you'll find a character.
It's like what they call a moment before an acting. It kind of kickstarts you into something is what you're saying.
Yeah. And I think I told Colbert this, and he, I don't know if it was him or somebody else that said, well, I was just copying Brian Unger.
Well, he said he was Brian Unger, but he also said Stone Phillips was part of.
Phillips. That's right. He said Stone Phillips but everybody else would be like Brian Unger was – no, I'm sorry. Brian Unger was the one that sort of created the field piece in a sense.
Right, right. He and Whitney Brown. And Brian, just his natural cadence and way of talking.
Exactly.
Like, it was like he was born out of Walter Cronkite's ass or something. He just came born out of Anchorman. Like, it's unbelievable. And he and Whitney just were amazing that, you know, the work they – along with Liz and Madeline, you know, and sort of developing that field piece stuff. But I never knew that. So you kind of start. But then you made it your own, though. And I can't.
Well, this is how. I mean, it's very simple.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's very simple. Sorry. It's very simple in that it just whatever I'm good at is naturally going to emerge in that very specific situation. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, that interview situation or that studio situation. Because and something I've never had a problem at playing is, and I will tell producers this when they're like, oh, we want to make your character more likable. And I'm like, don't worry about that. Like, I'm very good at playing arrogant, yet stupid, and somehow still likable.
Right.
It's that's, I don't have to really think about it. So that's what sort of emerged from,
now, where,
from that.
Was that from, for people who don't know you, you went to the University of Massachusetts Amherst. You were initially an English major for like a day and a half, and then you changed and went over into acting, and then you were doing straight acting and then for quite a while, and then moved over to improv at UCB. A couple of questions, like why did you sort of switch out of straight, and you're a very good actor. By the way, family loved you in Warm Bodies. My family, we love that movie. And we loved you in that movie, and I'm like, that's my friend Rob. And then,
I like that movie a lot. Thanks.
Yeah, that was a real nice movie with like a nice message and not too schmaltzy. It was a good movie, and you were really good in it, and showed your acting chops. So why did you move away from acting, straight acting? Not that you ever moved away from it, but like, why did improv become a focus for you? And the second part of the question is, in that improv experience, is that where you figured out how to be arrogant and likable? Because that's a hard thing to pull off.
I don't think that's where I discovered it. Basically, when I got out of college, I just did shitty Shakespeare on, you know, 42nd Street for a couple of years.
Right.
And it was just terrible. And really? I basically just auditioned. I decided to take Backstage Magazine and audition for everything. Like things I'm not even like... Like needed black women in their 50s who are handicapped and a lesbian. Like, I was just auditioned for everything because I knew that's what you had to be good at.
Right.
The rest of it, anybody can say a sentence believably. Mm. That, you know. So that's what I got good at. I got good at it, and then just happened to audition for a friend's sketch group. I think we even performed together, Third Rail at Gotham on Monday nights.
Oh, right.
Way back in the day.
Yeah.
Like 95, 96.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you'd go up there.
Yeah.
That's where I met a lot of stand-ups, actually, during that time. And it was a shitty sketch group, but I liked sketch, and I decided that's something I wanted to do, so I started Naked Babies, and then we all discovered sort of discovered the UCB at the same time, because I heard it was Andy Richter's sketch group from Chicago. I was like, great. I like Andy Richter, and I went and saw it and then got all, you know, wrapped up in that. But like, I was always during Shakespeare, I fancied myself a very important actor back then. And I was like, I'm going to be in the park in a year.
Right. Major
I got
plays
a Hamlet
in Central Park.
I don't have a Hamlet in me. Hamlet's too smart. I'm very good at playing. I'm always playing the jackasses, but the jackasses that don't think they're jackasses, and Shakespeare is polluted with them.
Right.
Always playing that character. So I guess it's just something that I fell into. And in improv, yeah, I'm always the cocky sort of arms akimbo, saying dumb things, like taking the space and being confident for no reason whatsoever.
Right.
Nothing to back it up.
But you made it your own on The Daily Show, still different from Colbert and Carell. And I give you a lot of credit for that because that's not easy to do. And, you know, clearly likable. And what I found interesting was that, you know, you talk about the auditioning process. And so for people who don't know what Backstage is basically an industry sort of magazine, if you will, where they put open call auditions in. And people can go and submit their headshots, even without an agent in some cases, and audition. And then I'm an actor and audition and blah, blah, blah. And it's not easy to audition. So what was it about auditioning? When did you make the turn to the point where did you have to reach that point? Some people say, well, you know, I just stopped giving a shit and just looked at it as I'm going in for another job. And then I forget about it when I leave. Like, when did you start to really get good at it? What was the turning point for you?
there's always a, there's even today, there's always a gig that you put too much stock into, you know, and you're bummed out when you don't get the audition, when you don't get the job. But I don't know. It's just the reality. I guess just when you, like I said before, like once, when you practice, see, I'm, when I said before that I'm not smart, it's true. Things don't come easy to me immediately. I have to practice and practice and practice.
I'm just like that.
Auditioning. And so then the more I audition, the more understanding I had of the process and that, and how impersonal and personal it is, and how I get it.
Yeah.
You know, I have to do it now. Like I have to audition people and it sucks. And I was like, oh my God, they've only been reading for like 3 seconds and I know I'm not going to cast them, but can I shut it off? Can I shut the video off? I can't. I got to watch this whole thing. These poor people. Fuck it.
I know.
You know? And like, yeah. It's tough. And the Daily Show, I knew like that was something I knew I could book. I don't know why. I think because first of all, I could do the news voice and I was always doing that sort of thing, like as a character for, you know, improv or with my friends. And I was a big fan of that show since Kilborn, like a big fan forever. And I was like, that I understand. I'm not the most political guy, but I don't think that matters. And I just practiced really. I even took a script and I taped it up to my wall in my bedroom and stood far enough away so I could read it to practice the prompter.
Wow.
Because I knew that was always a hiccup for people if you can't read it. And I could know I could read a prompter, but just like having it like that in front of me and knowing I didn't have to worry about certain things like memorizing it. But I did. Yeah. I ended up doing it.
Yeah. And then you talked about in reading some stuff, you talked about, you know, you thought you were just going to be an actor, and then you realized, well, you know, you kind of poo-pooed your idea of writing and producing and directing, and then decided, oh, maybe that was kind of a dumb approach because it closed off other avenues. When did that realization come to you? Was it when you started working at The Daily Show and you saw the value of correspondents having to also write, be involved in the writing of the field pieces, or was it after that?
No, it was after that. In retrospect, I'd look back on that and say, God, yeah, I did have a lot of fun writing that stuff, but mostly like I just felt like the dumbest guy in the room there, you know, because those writers are so smart in the geekiest, like, you know, politics, like they're just really bookish.
And then there's that producer, Adam Chodakoff, who literally Rain Man. Just so you know, these people are listening, this guy produced still there at Chod's, Adam Chodakoff, who started out as like a PA intern, whatever, brilliant, like kind of Rain Man-ish kind of guy. Who knows every fucking
knows best. Everything?
Unbelievable!
And there's so many people there that are just uncommonly intelligent, John included. Like,
oh yeah, absolutely.
You've ever seen him read a book? It's insane.
Yeah,
like he reads every book that is on the show because you know he's like fast.
Yeah. Well, I remember sitting in the writer's room after we would give, you know, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, they put the packet together what we wrote, and then you'd sit. He would sit with, I think at the time it was Ben and whoever, and he would flip through the pages so fast. Yes. I thought he was just scanning the jokes. And I remember the first time I saw him do it, I got a little insulted, like, you fucking asshole.
Read, I know. Fucking,
right? And then I realized, oh no, he's like a speed reader. And he's like, read, like it was, oh my God. Unbelievable.
Yeah. It's incredible. But anyway, like my point is that like, it was always hard for me. Like I always felt like I had to do more, like, because I had to make up for a deficit in that writer's room, just lacking that kind of knowledge. And you know, that's sort of just what I do because I have to, unfortunately. I don't like it. But then it just became, when I got out here, it became a thing, like, whenever I'd meet people, they'd be like, so you're an actor, good. And I assume you're a writer. And I got that so much that I'm like, you got to be a writer.
Why were they assuming that you were a writer? Why?
Because it's the thing. I mean, it's so much more than ever. Like, if you're in comedy and you're, you know, guys like me, guys that came up, you know, whatever. I mean, most people that we know, I think, right now that are acting and writing are like, because people assume that they do. And also it's good because I on a practical level, like, you just always want to be able to generate your own material because I will never be like reliant on someone else.
Yeah.
I can't. Well,
you, I mean, you've done it in spades with Children's Hospital. I mean, that's just been such a great. Are you guys going to do another run of that, or are you done, or what's the plan on it?
Yeah, no. I'm going to do it. I mean, I'm taking a break. We usually start writing around now, and we shoot in December and January. But like, it's been too much. We've done that nonstop for 5 years. So once you stop editing and promoting, it's you're writing again, and it became overwhelming. The last season, it really killed me writing this last season. So,
why was this last season different than any other season? Just busier other stuff on your plate,
Every year things gradually get a little busier and other stuff, and you can only manage it so much before it starts to encroach on your creative juice. And also, we got a little cocky, I think maybe, and we always throw out an episode or two before we shoot. And just end up writing another one, you know, in its place because we can't figure it out. Mm-hmm. And this time we're like, we can do it. And we were writing a lot when we were shooting. And it was just, it became really, really exhausting. And so I haven't really written anything since like February.
Wow. Well, but, you know, let me ask you about that because in deciding, you know, when the show first got picked up, you had an opportunity to do it at Comedy Central as a half-hour format, and you decided to go in the shorter format, an Adult Swim. And why is that? Why did you make that choice? Because a lot of people would have gone the other way.
Yeah, well, that's funny, too, because, I even think somebody might have even been John, you know, oh, no, Corson, you know, the guy, one of the guys that worked for John and John's company outside, I think he was cool about it, but he was like, why aren't you staying in the family?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's comes down to a very simple, the pitch call. I basically only was interested in pitching to, Adult Swim and Comedy Central. Mm-hmm. And, you know, talk to Adult Swim, had a great conversation, and then talk to Comedy Central, and you know they gave me notes like in the call,
Jesus,
like in the pitch, and they were bad.
Oh, really?
They were bad.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, and then I just got this was at a time when Comedy Central was experiencing one of their periodic growing pains.
It's a nice way to say it.
They're in a very good position right now, but this is coming out of a slump, you know. And
do you remember one of the notes? Can you say, like, do you remember one of the things that they said that would just stands out as being absurd?
No.
Yeah.
No, but I can remember one not for Comedy Central. Who was it? My brother and I were pitching. This is a classic note. My brother and I were pitching this web series we were going to do, and we just ran out of time. We couldn't do it. Called the Cordry Brothers. We're both play ourselves. We quit being actors, and we decided to start a rock band, though neither of us can play our instruments. But we're that cocky. We're that dumb and cocky. And we decided to do it. And we couldn't. We pitched it around, and people were really interested. One company, and it was one of those web thing, like, I don't know, Sony Crackle or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was like, it was like, okay, all right, we love it. We love it. Love the thing. Cordry, the Cordry Brothers band. Can it be Cordry Brothers Rock Band? You know, the game, Rock Band. So you guys start a band with Rock Band, you know? And of course, like, for the products. And there was this long pause on the call, and my brother and I weren't in the same room. And my brother goes, sure, why don't we set it on the moon?
Oh, Jesus.
And that is basically the equivalent of a click.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know? A little bit of a finger and then you're gone. Right, exactly.
Never been prouder of him.
So that's pretty funny. I'm doing it on the moon. Great. That's great. Now, so let me ask you. So was it also an issue for you, Adult Swim, to kind of do a shorter format because you felt like you could just – you have more control over the product, the quality, less daunting process or any of that?
Adult Swim would have been happy doing a half hour. As a matter of fact, they still say it, like, you know, you can do as much as you want.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't think that kind of comedy will sustain itself past past 15 minutes. I really
don't. Because it's so absurd. I mean, you've talked about satire versus absurdity and not really liking comedy. You like your comedy to be completely unimportant, to use a quote that you've put out there, even though you come out of The Daily Show. But the joke of The Daily Show is we're overly self-important. Talk about that a little bit and why you think that the 15-minute format really works for you.
Wait, say the beginning part again?
The part about satire versus absurdity. I mean, I think you're saying the 15 minutes works because it's such an absurd – the show's so funny but so absurd that it couldn't sustain more than 15 minutes. Is that the reason?
Right. Yeah. And also just because then – I mean, in a half-an-hour format – with that length, you have to tell more of an actual story.
Right.
We have stories. We've learned that that's the best joke engine, but we're purely a joke-based show. And also, like, one of the things about our show is that we mess with the conventions of storytelling.
Yeah. And you have said in the last couple of seasons that you focus less on joke, although the jokes are there, and more on the story and the character development, and that's been an intentional shift for you.
Only because we shoot it for a while, and we were like, this is just about jokes. But I've learned as I became a better writer that story and character are the best joke generators.
Right.
So
right.
Now we'll have like six stories going at once, but yet we don't have to wrap them up in a traditionally satisfying way because it's all about really fucking with the audience's expectations.
Yeah.
And well, that's absurdity. Absurdity is you can be a lot freer because you have to set your own rules and you have to stick by your own rules. And whether that's in a scene, an episode, or a whole show, but we've got a couple, maybe general ones, but you also have a larger toolbox. You can use parody and satire in absurdity, but
right.
there you can't. Satire because it's reality, very based in political or whatever reality. Satire can't really involve absurdity,
right?
Whereas parody can. It's a weird thing. I've thought way too much about.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. The other thing that you hit on is Michael Bay. I mean, I know you worked with him in Pain and Gain, and that you're fascinated by him.
Good friend.
What is it about him, just in a nutshell and wrapping up, like what that sort of fascinates you about him and his work?
Well, he has such a weird reputation. I can't really say bad, but I mean, like, you know, if you fancy yourself an artist, you're not going to like his work, right? And I'm a huge fan of a lot of his things, like, you know, Bad Boys is one of the best action comedies, like real action comedies in a long time.
Right.
But, you know, and The Rock is awesome.
Yeah.
But, so I appreciate what he does, you know, in the same way I appreciate like whatever that Danish Nazi guy is, Lars von Trier. Lars, I'm totally kidding. I'm kidding you, bro.
Hey, he's a good friend of mine. Okay?
Bro. No. But like,
but you watched this process. You worked with him. It sounds like you've learned from working.
Well, I learned that. By the way, don't take what people say for granted. Like, he can be a dick.
Oh, really?
And oh, fuck yeah, he can be a dick, and yet people still work with him, movie after movie after movie, because when you watch him work, no one works harder, no one works faster, and he demands excellence, at least he demands the same kind of hard work.
Yeah.
And that motivates me. You know what I mean? Like, I like watching people's process and how they do efficiency. And like, he is, you know, sure, it's sometimes at others' expense. I saw a lot of like, what a makeup women get yelled at, but like, I really do think that he is a very, very hardworking man, and he has my respect for that, for sure.
Yeah, I'm with you about process. Listen, I can't thank you enough for doing this. You're the best. And when I come out, I may be coming out to LA shortly. I'm going to call you. Maybe we'll grab a beer.
No, I can't. I'm busy.
Oh, wow. I'm going to be busy putting in a new air conditioning system.
I got a whole rig. I'm a new Frigidaire.
All right. People can follow.
If you call, that'd be great. Everybody, as a matter of fact, that's listening, give me a call.
Call. It's 917.
917.
7685A.
6 number sign. Bloop. Actually, the sound bloop. Question mark. 1.
All right, follow Rob at Rob Corddry, 2 D's. He's got the Hot Tub 2 coming out in March. Children's Hospital, watch that. Hilariously funny. You're working on a new show, a spinoff of that, Newsreaders. And I hope you do Warm Bodies, too. And you're the best. I appreciate it.
You're the best. Thank you for having me on, man. This is fun.
All right, see you, man.
All right, that was my good buddy, Rob Corddry. How fun is he? He's got some amazing sweat glands. Hey, this weekend, March 9th to the 11th, I'm going to be at Levity Live in Nyack, New York, just outside of New York City. So if you're in the area, come on out. March 23rd to the 26th at the Comic Strip in Edmonton, Canada. March 29th to April 1st, I'm in San Francisco at the Punchline. And April 13th to the 15th, I know it's Easter, but bring some chocolate and come on out to Royal Oak, Michigan, the Comedy Castle in Royal Oak, Michigan, just outside of Detroit. Great club. And please go review the podcast. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a great time with this one, and we'll give you a new one next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.